Star Wars, Dark Force Rising by Timothy Zahn. Trademark and copyright 1992 by Lucasfilm Limited. All rights reserved. Used under authorization. This recording of the full-length reading of Star Wars, Dark Force Rising was published by arrangement with Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio, a division of Bantam Doubleday Dell Publishing Group, Incorporated, and was produced in 1995 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by Larry A. McKeever. Please observe the following procedures as you listen to these tapes. If you have borrowed this book from your local library, please return it to them at the end of the agreed period. If you are one of our regular rental customers, you may keep your book for 30 days from date of receipt by you, but after that time, we charge additional rental of 25 cents per day. Dates are checked by postmark. Please return this book at the earliest possible time so another subscriber can have the use of this recording. To return cassettes to us, simply make sure they are all packaged in their plastic cassette cases and in proper order in the mailing container. Kindly seal the mailing container for return. Postage is already paid. Drop in any mailbox for return to Books on Tape. Should a cassette fail to play properly, hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, or if you cannot otherwise free the reels and you are a library customer, please ask your local library to contact Books on Tape for a replacement cassette. If you are one of our rental customers, please call us at our regular customer service number. Give us the name of the book and number of the cassette. We will immediately send you a replacement at no charge. Discard the broken cassette. Star Wars, Dark Force Rising by Timothy Zahn. This book consists of 29 chapters and is 376 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Dark Force Rising, the number one New York Times best-selling Heir to the Empire, was the publishing event of the year, the first novel to continue the adventures of Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, and Han Solo, beyond the events of the most popular trilogy in movie history. Now comes Dark Force Rising, the second volume of a three-book cycle authorized by Lucasfilm Limited and written by Hugo Award-winning author Timothy Zahn. 5 years after the events of Return of the Jedi, the fragile republic that was born with the defeat of Darth Vader, the Emperor, and the infamous Death Star, stands threatened from within and without. The dying Empire's most cunning and ruthless warlord, Grand Admiral Thrawn, has taken command of the remnants of the Imperial fleet and launched a massive campaign aimed at the Republic's destruction. With the aid of unimaginable weapons, long hidden away by the Emperor on a backwater planet, Thrawn plans to turn the tide of the battle, overwhelm the new Republic, and impose his iron rule throughout the galaxy. Meanwhile, dissension and personal ambition threaten to tear the Republic apart. As Princess Leia, pregnant with Jedi twins, risks her life to bring a proud and lethal alien race into alliance with the Republic, Han and Lando Calrissian race against time to find proof of treason inside the highest Republic Council, only to discover instead a ghostly fleet of warships that could bring doom to their friends and victory to their enemies. But most dangerous of all is a new dark Jedi, risen from the ashes of a shrouded past, consumed by bitterness, and thoroughly, utterly insane. Now he schemes to use his awesome mastery of the Force to summon young Skywalker, allay his misgivings, cunningly enthrall him, and ultimately corrupt him to the dark side. A tale of brilliant spectacle, startling revelations, and tumultuous action, Dark Force Rising moves with the speed of light across a dazzling, epic landscape of galactic proportions, from world to world, from adventure to adventure, as good and evil clash across the vastness of space, a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Timothy Zahn is one of science fiction's most popular voices, known for his ability to tell very human stories against a well-researched background of future science and technology. He won the Hugo Award for his novella Cascade Point and is the author of 11 science fiction novels, including Cobra, The Black Collar, and War Horse, as well as two collections of short fiction. He just completed the novel Angel Mass for Bantam Spectra and is currently at work on the third novel in the new Star Wars cycle. Timothy Zahn lives on the Oregon coast. Chapter 1. Directly ahead, the star was a marble-sized yellow-orange ball, its intensity moderated by its distance and by the viewport's automatic sunscreens. Surrounding it and the ship itself were the stars, a spattering of blazing white pinpricks in the deep blackness of space. Directly beneath the ship, in the western part of the great northern forest of the planet Mirker, dawn was approaching. The last dawn that some in that forest would ever see. Standing at one of the side bridge viewports of the Imperial Star Destroyer Chimera, Captain Pelion watched as the fuzzy Terminator line crept toward the target zone on the planet below. 10 minutes ago, the ground forces surrounding the target had reported themselves ready. The Chimera itself had been holding blockade position for nearly an hour. All that was missing now was the order to attack. Slowly, feeling almost furtive about it, Pelion turned his head a couple of centimeters to the side. Behind him and to his right, Grand Admiral Thrawn was seated at his command station, his blue-skinned face expressionless, his glowing red eyes focused on the bank of status readouts wrapped around his chair. He hadn't spoken or moved from that position since the last of the ground forces had reported in, and Pelion could tell the bridge crew was beginning to get restless. For his own part, Pelion had long since stopped trying to second-guess Thrawn's actions. The fact that the late Emperor had seen fit to make Thrawn one of his 12 Grand Admirals was evidence of his own confidence in the man. All the more so, given Thrawn's not entirely human heritage and the Emperor's well-known prejudices in such matters. Moreover, in the year since Thrawn had taken command of the Chimera and had begun the task of rebuilding the Imperial fleet, Pelion had seen the Grand Admiral's military genius demonstrated time and again. Whatever his reason for holding off the attack, Pelion knew it was a good one. As slowly as he'd turned away, he turned back to the viewport. But his movements had apparently not gone unnoticed. "A question, Captain?" Thrawn's smoothly modulated voice cut through the low hum of bridge conversation. "No, sir," Pelion assured him, turning again to face his superior. For a moment, those glowing eyes studied him, and Pelion unconsciously braced himself for a reprimand or worse. But Thrawn, as Pelion still had a tendency to forget, did not have the legendary and lethal temper that had been the hallmark of the Lord Darth Vader. "You're perhaps wondering why we haven't yet attacked," the Grand Admiral suggested in that same courteous tone. "Yes, sir, I was," Pelion admitted. "All our forces appear to be in position." "Our military forces are, yes," Thrawn agreed, "but not the observers I sent to the city." Pelion blinked. "Hilliard City?" "Yes. I find it unlikely that a man of Talon Karda's cunning would set up a base in the middle of a forest without also setting up security contacts with others outside the immediate area. Hilliard City is too far from Karda's base for anyone there to directly witness our attack. Hence, any sudden flurries of activity in the city will imply the existence of a more subtle line of communication. From that, we'll be able to identify Karda's contacts and put them under long-term surveillance. Eventually, they'll lead us to him." "Yes, sir," Pelion said, feeling a frown crease his forehead. "Then you're not expecting to take any of Karda's own people alive?" The Grand Admiral's smile turned brittle. "On the contrary, I fully expect our forces to find an empty and abandoned base. Helion threw a glance out the viewport at the partly lit planet below. In that case, sir, why are we attacking it? Three reasons, Captain. First, even men like Alan Carter occasionally make mistakes. It could well be that in the rush to evacuate his base, he left some crucial bit of information behind. Second, as I've already mentioned, an attack on the base may lead us to his contacts in Hilliard City. And third, it provides our ground force with some badly needed field experience. The glowing eyes bored into Pelion's face. Never forget, Captain, that our goal is no longer merely the pitiful rearguard harassment of the past 5 years. With Mount Tentus and our late Emperor's collection of Sperti cylinders in our hands, the initiative is once again ours. Very soon now, we'll begin the process of taking planets back from the Rebellion. And for that, we'll need an army every bit as well trained as the officers and crew of the fleet. Understood, Admiral, Pelion said. Good. Thrawn lowered his gaze to his displays. It's time. Signal General Covell that he may begin. Yes, sir, Pelion said, leaving the viewport and returning to his station. He gave the readouts a quick check and tapped his comm switch, peripherally aware as he did so that Thrawn had likewise activated his own comm. Some private message to his spies in Hilliard City? This is the Chimera, Pelion said. Launch the attack. Acknowledged, Chimera, General Covell said into his helmet comlink, careful to keep the quiet scorn in his gut from getting through to his voice. It was typical. Typical and disgustingly predictable. You scrambled around like mad hellions, got your troops and vehicles on the ground and set up. And then you stood around waiting for those Starfleet people in their spotless uniforms and nice clean ships to finish sipping their tea and finally get around to letting you loose. Well, get yourselves comfortable, he thought sardonically, in the direction of the Star Destroyer overhead. Because whether Grand Admiral Thrawn was interested in real results, or just a good rousing show, he was going to get his money's worth. Reaching to the board in front of him, he keyed for low command frequency. General Bell to all units, we've got the light, let's go. Acknowledgement came in, and with a shiver from the steel deck beneath him, the huge AT-AT Walker was off, lumbering its deceptively awkward-looking way through the forest toward the encampment a kilometer away. Ahead of the AT-AT, occasionally visible through the armored transparent steel viewport, a pair of AT-ST scout walkers ran in twin-point formation, tracking along the AT-AT's path and watching for enemy positions or booby traps. Not that such futile gestures would do Carda any good. Covell had directed literally hundreds of assault campaigns in his years of Imperial service, and he knew full well the awesome capabilities of the fighting machines under his command. Beneath the viewport, the holographic tactical display was lit up like a decorative disc, the winking red, white, and green lights showing the positions of Covell's circle of AT-ATs, AT-STs, and Hover Scout attack vehicles, all closing on Carda's encampment in good order. Good, but not perfect. The north flank AT-AT and its support vehicles were lagging noticeably behind the rest of the armored nukes. You two, red, he said into his comlink. Trainer, the voice came back, tinny and distant, through the strange jamming effects of Mirror's battle rate. We're encountering some thick vine clusters that are slowing down our scout walkers. Is it bothering your AT-AT any? No, sir, but I wanted to keep the flank together. Pattern coherence is a fine goal during Academy maneuvers, Major, Covell cut him off, but not at the expense of an overall battle plan. If the AT-STs can't keep up, leave them behind. Yes, sir. Covell broke the connection with a snort. The Grand Admiral was right about one thing, at least. His troops were going to need a lot more battle seasoning before they would be up to real imperial standards. Still, the raw material was there. Even as he watched, the north flank reformed itself, with the hover scout spreading forward to take up the ATST's former point positions, while the lagging ATSTs themselves fell back into rearguard deployment. The energy sensor beeped a proximity warning. They were coming up on the encampment. "Status?" he asked his crew. "All weapons charged and ready," the gunner reported, his eyes on the targeting displays. "No indications of resistance, active or passive," the driver added. "Stay alert," Cobell ordered, keying for command frequency again. "All units, move in." And with a final crash of mangled vegetation, the AT-AT broke through into the clearing. It was an impressive sight. From all four sides of the open area, in nearly perfect parade ground unison, the other three AT-ATs appeared from the forest cover in the pre-dawn gloom. The AT-STs and hover scouts clustered around their feet, quickly fanning out on all sides to encircle the darkened buildings. Covell gave the sensors a quick but thorough check. Two energy sources were still functioning, one in the central building, the other in one of the outer barrack-style structures. There was no evidence of operating sensors or of weapons or energy fields. The lifeform analyzer ran through its complicated algorithms and concluded that the outer buildings were devoid of life. The large main building, on the other hand... "I'm getting approximately 20 lifeform readings from the main building, General," the number 4 AT-AT commander reported. "All in the central section." "They don't register as human, though," Covell's driver murmured. "Maybe they're being shielded," Covell grunted, looking out the viewport. Still, no movement from the encampment. "Let's find out. Assault squads, go." The hover scouts popped their aft hatchways, and from each came a squad of 8 soldiers, laser rifles held tautly across battle-armored chests as they dropped to the ground. Half of each squad took up backstop position, their rifles trained on the encampment from the partial cover of their hover scout, while the other half sprinted across the open ground to the outer line of buildings and sheds. There, they assumed covering positions, allowing their comrades in the rear to similarly advance. It was a centuries-old military tactic, executed with the kind of squeamish determination that Covell would have expected of green troops. Still, the raw material was definitely there. The soldiers continued their leapfrog approach to the main building, with small groups breaking off the main encirclement to check out each of the outer structures as they passed. The point men reached the central building. A brilliant flash lit up the forest as they blasted down the door. A slightly confused scramble as the rest of the troops piled through. And then, silence. For a handful of minutes, the silence continued, punctuated only by occasional short commands from the troop commanders. Covell listened, watching the sensors, and finally the report came through. "General Covell, this is Lieutenant Barse. We've secured the target zone, sir. There's no one here." Covell nodded. "Very good, Lieutenant. How does it look?" "Like they pulled out in a hurry, sir," the other said. "They left a fair amount of stuff behind, but it all looks pretty much like junk." "That'll be for the scanning crew to decide," Covell told him. "Any indication of booby traps or other unpleasant surprises?" "None at all, sir. Oh, and those life forms we picked up are nothing but these long, furry animals living on the tree growing up through the center of the roof." Covell nodded again. Isalamiri, he believed they were called. Thrawn had been making a big deal about the stupid creatures for a couple of months now, though what use they could possibly be to the war effort, he couldn't guess. Eventually, he supposed, the fleet people would get around to letting him in on the big secret. "Set up a defensive honeycomb," he ordered the lieutenant. "Signal the scanning crew when you're ready. And get comfortable. The Grand Admiral wants this place taken apart, and that's exactly what we're going to do." "Very good, General," the voice said, almost too faint to hear, despite the heavy amplification and computer scrubbing. "Proceed with the dismantling." Seated at the wild card's helm, Mara Jade half turned to face the man standing behind her. "I suppose that's it, then," she said. For a moment, Talon Karda didn't seem to hear her. He just stood there, gazing through the viewport at the distant planet, a tiny bluish-white crescent shape visible around the jagged edge of the sun-skimmer asteroid the Wild Karda was snuggled up against. Mara was just about to repeat the comment when he stirred. "Yes," he said, that calm voice showing no hint of the emotion he was obviously feeling. "I suppose it is." Mara exchanged glances with Avis at the co-pilot station, then looked back up at Karda. "Shouldn't we be going, then?" she prompted. Karda took a deep breath, and as she watched him, Mara caught in his expression a glimmer of what the Mirkur base had meant to him. More than just a base, it had been his home. With an effort, she suppressed the thought. So Karda had lost his home. Big deal. She'd lost far more than that in her lifetime and had survived just fine. He'd get over it. "I asked if we should get going." "I heard you," Karda said, the flicker of emotion vanishing again into that slightly sardonic facade of his. "I think perhaps we ought to wait a little longer. See if we left anything behind that might point in the direction of our Rishi base." Mara looked at Avis again. "We were pretty thorough," Avis said. "I don't think there was any mention of Rishi anywhere except the main computer, and that left with the first group out." "I agree," Karda said. "Are you willing to stake your life on that assessment?" Avis's lip twitched. "Not really." "Nor am I. So we wait."
"What if they spot us?" Mara persisted. "Skulking behind asteroids is the oldest trick on the list."
"They won't spot us," Karda was quietly positive. "Actually, I doubt the possibility will even occur to them. The average man running from the likes of Grand Admiral Thrawn is unlikely to stop running until he's a good deal farther away than this."
"Are you willing to stake your life on that assessment?" Mara thought sourly. But she kept the retort to herself. He was probably right. And anyway, if the Chimera or any of its TIE fighters started toward Wild Karda, they would have no trouble punching the engines up to power and going to light speed well ahead of the attack. The logic and tactics seemed clean. But still, Mara could feel something nagging at the back of her mind. Something that didn't feel good about all this. Gritting her teeth, she adjusted the ship's sensors to their highest sensitivity and checked once more that the engine pre-start sequence was keyed in and ready. And then settled in to wait. The scanning crew was fast, efficient, and thorough, and it took them just over 30 minutes to come up completely dry. "Well, so much for that," Pelion grimaced, as he watched the negative reports scroll up his display. "A good practice session for the ground forces, perhaps. But otherwise, the whole exercise seemed to have been pretty useless. Unless your observers have picked up any reactions in Hilliard City," he added, turning to face Thrawn. The Grand Admiral's glowing red eyes were on his displays. "There was a small twitch, as a matter of fact," he said. "Cut off almost before it began, but I think the implications are clear." Well, that was something anyway. Yes, sir. Shall I have surveillance begin equipping a long-term ground team?
Patience, Captain, Thrawn said. It may not be necessary after all. Key for a mid-range scan and tell me what you see.
Pelion swiveled back to his command board and tapped for the appropriate readout. There was Mirkur itself, of course, and the standard TIE fighter defense cloud ranged around the Chimera. The only other object anywhere within mid-range distance. You mean that little asteroid out there?
That's the one, Thrawn nodded. Nothing remarkable about it, is there? No, don't do a sensor focus, he added, almost before the thought of doing one had even occurred to Pelion. We wouldn't want to prematurely flush our quarry, would we?
Our quarry? Pelion repeated, frowning at the sensor data again. The routine sensor scans that had been done of the asteroid 3 hours earlier had come up negative, and nothing could have sneaked up on it since then without being detected. With all due respect, sir, I don't see any indication that anything's out there.
I don't either, Thrawn agreed. But it's the only sizable cover available for nearly 10 million kilometers around Mirkur. There's really no other place for Carda to watch our operation from.
Pelion pursed his lips. Your permission, Admiral, but I doubt Carda is foolish enough to just sit around waiting for us to arrive. The glowing red eyes narrowed just a bit.
You forget, Captain, he said softly, that I've met the man. More important, I've seen the sort of artwork he collects.
He turned back to his displays.
No, he's out there. I'm sure of it. Talon Carda is not merely a smuggler, you see. Perhaps not even primarily a smuggler. His real love is not goods or money, but information. More than anything else in the galaxy, he craves knowledge. And the knowledge of what we have or have not found here is too valuable a gem for him to pass up.
Pelion studied the Grand Admiral's profile. It was, in his opinion, a pretty tenuous leap of logic. But on the other hand, he'd seen too many similar leaps borne out not to take this one seriously. Shall I order a TIE fighter squadron to investigate, sir?
As I said, Captain, patience, Thrawn said. Even in sensor stealth mode, with all engines shut down, he'll have made sure he can power up and escape before any attack force could reach him.
He smiled at Pelion.
Or rather, any attack force from the Chimera.
A stray memory clicked. Thrawn, reaching for his comm just as Pelion was giving the ground forces the order to attack. You sent a message to the rest of the fleet, he said, timing it against my attack order to mask the transmission. Thrawn's blue-black eyebrows lifted a fraction.
Very good, Captain. Very good indeed.
Pelion felt a touch of warmth on his cheeks. The Grand Admiral's compliments were few and far between.
Thank you, sir.
Thrawn nodded.
More precisely, my message was to a single ship, the Constrainer. It will arrive in approximately 10 minutes, at which point, his eyes glittered, we'll see just how accurate my reading of Carda has been.
Over the wild Carda's bridge speakers, the reports from the scanning crew were beginning to taper off.
Doesn't sound like they've found anything, Avis commented.
Like you said, we were thorough,
Mara reminded him, hardly hearing her own words.
The nameless thing nagging at the back of her mind seemed to be getting stronger.
Can we get out of here now?
She asked, turning to look at Carda. He frowned down at her.
Try to relax, Mara.
They can't possibly know we're here. There's been no sensor focus probe of the asteroid, and without one, there's no way for them to detect this ship.
Unless a Star Destroyer's sensors are better than you think,
Mara retorted. We know all about their sensors, Abe soothed. Ease up, Mara. Karda knows what he's doing. The Wild Karda has probably the tightest sensor stealth mode this side of...
He broke off as the bridge door opened behind them, and Mara turned just as Karda's two pet Vornskers bounded into the room, dragging, very literally, their handler behind them.
What are you doing here, Chin? Karda asked.
Sorry, Captain, Chin puffed, digging his heels into the deck and leaning back against the taut leashes.
The effort was only partially successful. The predators were still pulling him slowly forward.
I couldn't stop them. I thought maybe they wanted to see you, he?
What's the matter with you two, anyway? Karda chided the animals, squatting down in front of them. Don't you know we're busy?
The Vornskers didn't look at him, didn't even seem to notice his presence, for that matter. They continued staring straight ahead, as if he wasn't even there. Staring directly at Mara.
Hey, Karda said, reaching over to slap one of the animals lightly across the muzzle. I'm talking to you, Storm. What's gotten into you anyway?
He glanced along their unblinking line of sight. Paused for a second and longer look.
Are you doing something, Mara?
Mara shook her head, a cold shiver tingling up her back. She'd seen that look before, on many of the wild Vornskers she'd run into during that long 3-day trek through the Mirker Forest with Luke Skywalker. Except that those Vornsker stares hadn't been directed at her. They'd been reserved instead for Skywalker, usually just before they attacked him.
That's Mara, Storm, Karda told the animal, speaking to it as he might a child.
Mara, come on now, you saw her all the time back home.
Slowly, almost reluctantly, Storm stopped his forward pull and turned his attention to his master.
Mara, Karda repeated, looking the Vornsker firmly in the eye.
A friend. You hear that, Drang? He added, reaching over to grip the other Vornsker's muzzle. She's a friend, understand?
Drang seemed to consider that. Then, as reluctantly as Storm had, he lowered his head and stopped pulling.
That's better, Karda said, scratching both Vornskers briefly behind their ears and standing up again.
Better take them back down, Chin. Maybe walk them around the main hold. Give them some exercise.
If I can find a clear track through all the stuff in there, he?
Chin grunted, twitching back on the leashes.
Come on, littles. We go now.
With only a slight hesitation, the two Vornskers allowed him to take them off the bridge. Karda watched as the door shut behind them.
I wonder what that was all about, he said, giving Mara a thoughtful look.
I don't know, she told him, hearing the tightness in her voice.
With the temporary distraction now gone, the strange dread she'd been feeling was back again in full force. She swiveled back to her board, half expecting to see a squadron of TIE fighters bearing down on them. But there was nothing, only the Chimera still sitting harmlessly out there in orbit around Mirker. No threat any of the Wild Karda's instruments could detect. But the tingling was getting stronger and stronger. And suddenly she could sit still no longer. Reaching out to the control board, she keyed for engine pre-start.
Mara, Avis yelped, jumping in his seat as if he'd been stung. What in...
They're coming, Mara snarled back, hearing the strain of a half dozen tangled emotions in her voice.
The die was irrevocably cast. Her activation of the Wild Karda's engines would have set sensors screaming all over the Chimera. Now there was nowhere to go but out. She looked up at Karda, suddenly afraid of what his expression might be saying. But he was just standing there looking down at her, a slightly quizzical frown on his face.
They don't appear to be coming, he pointed out mildly.
She shook her head, feeling the pleading in her eyes.
You have to believe me, she said,
uncomfortably aware that she didn't really believe it herself.
They're getting ready to attack.
I believe you, he said soothingly. Or perhaps he, too, recognized that there weren't any other choices left.
Aves, light speed calculation. Take the easiest course setting that's not anywhere toward Rishi. We'll stop and reset later.
Karda?
Mara is second in command, Karda cut him off. As such, she has the right and the duty to make important decisions.
Yeah, but...
Aves stopped, last word coming out pinched as he strangled it off.
Yeah,
he said between clenched teeth.
Throwing a glower at Mara, he turned to the nav computer and got to work.
You might as well get us moving, Mara, Karda continued, stepping over to the vacant communications chair and sitting down. Keep the asteroid between us and the Chimera as long as you can.
Yes, sir,
Mara said. Her tangle of emotions was starting to dissolve now, leaving a mixture of anger and profound embarrassment in its wake. She'd done it again. Listened to her inner feelings, tried to do things she knew full well she couldn't do, and in us had once again wound up touching the sharp end of the bayonet. And it was probably last she'd hear of being Karda's second in command, too. Command unity in front of Aves was one thing, but once they were out of here, and he could get her alone, there was going to be hell to pay. She'd be lucky if he didn't bounce her out of his organization altogether. Jabbing viciously at her board, she swung the wild card around, turning its nose away from the asteroid and starting to drive toward deep space. And with a flicker of pseudo-motion, something big shot in from lightspeed, dropping neatly into normal space not 20 kilometers away. An Imperial Interdictor cruiser.
Aves yelped a startled-sounding curse.
We got company, he barked.
I see it, Karda said, as cool as ever. But Mara could hear the tinge of surprise in his voice, too. What's our time to light speed?
It'll be another minute, Aves said tautly. There's a lot of junk in the outer system for the computer to work through.
We have a race, then, Karda said. Mara?
Up to 0.73, she said, nursing as much power as she could out of the still sluggish engines.
He was right. It was indeed going to be a race. With their four huge gravity wave generators capable of simulating planet-sized masses, Interdictor cruisers were the Empire's weapon of choice for trapping an enemy ship in normal space, while TIE fighters pounded it to rubble. But coming in fresh out of lightspeed itself, the Interdictor would need another minute before it could power up those generators. If she could get the Wildcat out of range.
More visitors, Aves announced. A couple squadrons of TIE fighters coming up from the Chimera.
We're up to 0.86 power, Mara reported. We'll be ready for light speed as soon as the nav computer gives me a course.
Interdictor status.
Grav generators are powering up, Aves said. On Mara's tactical display, a ghostly cone appeared, showing the area where the light speed dampening field would soon exist. She changed course slightly, aiming for the nearest edge, and risked a glance at the nav computer display.
Almost ready. The hazy grav cone was rapidly becoming more substantial.
The computer scope pinged. Mara wrapped her hand around the three hyperspace control levers at the front of the control board and gently pulled them toward her. The wild card shuddered slightly, and for a second it seemed that the Interdictor had won their deadly race. Then, abruptly, the stars outside burst into star lines. They'd made it.
Aves heaved a sigh of relief as the star lines faded into the mottled sky of hyperspace.
Talk about slicing the Minok close to the hull. How do you suppose they tumbled that we were out there, anyway?
No idea, Carter said, his voice cool. Mara?
I don't know, either.
Mara kept her eyes on her displays, not daring to look at either of them.
Thrawn may have just been playing a hunch. He does that sometimes.
Lucky for us, he's not the only one who gets hunches, Aves offered, his voice sounding a little strange. Nice going, Mara. Sorry I jumped on you.
Yes, Carter seconded. A very good job indeed.
Thanks,
Mara muttered, keeping her eyes on her control board and blinking back the tears that had suddenly come to her eyes. So, it was back. She'd hoped fervently her locating Skywalker's echoing on deep space had been an isolated event. A fluke, more his doing than hers. But no, it was all coming back, as it had so many times before in the past 5 years. The hunches and sensory flickers, the urges and the compulsions. Which meant that very soon now the dreams would probably be starting again, too. Angrily, she swiped at her eyes, and with an effort unclenched her jaw. It was a familiar enough pattern, but this time things were going to be different. Always before, there'd been nothing she could do about the voices and urges, except to suffer through the cycle. To suffer, and to be ready to break out of whatever niche she'd managed to carve for herself when she finally betrayed herself to those around her. But she wasn't a serving girl in a Forless cantina this time, or a come-up flector for a swoop gang on Caprioreel, or even a hyperdrive mechanic stuck in the backwater of the Ison Corridor. She was second in command to the most powerful smuggler in the galaxy, with the kind of resources and mobility she hadn't had since the death of the Emperor. The kind of resources that would let her find Luke Skywalker again and kill him. Maybe then the voices would stop. For a long minute, Thrawn stood at the bridge viewport, looking out at the distant asteroid and the now superfluous interdictor cruiser near it. It was, Pelion thought uneasily, almost the identical posture the Grand Admiral had assumed when Luke Skywalker had so recently escaped a similar trap. Holding his breath, Pelion stared at Thrawn's back, wondering if another of the Chimera's crewers was about to be executed for this failure. Thrawn turned around. Interesting, he said, his voice conversational. Did you note the sequence of events, Captain?
Yes, sir, Pelion said cautiously. The target was already powering up before the constrainer arrived.
Yes, Thrawn nodded. And it implies one of three things. Either Carda was about to leave anyway, or else he panicked for some reason.
The red eyes glittered. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.